Focus on your goal, Sarah. It's just a random smell, she told herself, that's triggering hard memories. Still, she couldn't quite flick it away. She stepped into the kitchen and opened the refrigerator, which was mostly bare. A container of coffee, butter, a shriveled lemon hard as horn. And in the crisper, an onion. It too was past prime, but not rotten. Green shoots were growing from the end. Eerie. She thought of Joseph's unruly hair, slick, greasy. She found a knife, dull but sharp enough to slice the vegetable if she sawed with pressure. When she'd produced a small pile of rings, she found oil in the cupboard, which she poured into a dusty frying pan without bothering to wipe it clean. She turned up the heat and cooked the rings and shoots, stirring them absently in a figure-eight motion with a wooden spoon. The sweet scents rose, and soon they'd mitigated the smells that had bothered her. The thoughts of past death faded. Daniel Reardon walked to the doorway of the kitchen. She sensed him watching her closely. She glanced at his handsome face, felt that pang of attraction. Thought of Friday night 2 days ago. A year. Forever.
Hungry?
Probably. But I don't want anything to eat, I'm just air freshening.
With onions?
A laugh. He had a wonderful laugh, just like the actor he so closely resembled. Her voice shivered as she said, Every night when she's with me, Sarah and I cook. Well, not every night, but most. She likes to stir things. She's a great stirrer. We sometimes joke, we... And she abruptly fell silent, inhaled deeply, looking away from him. She touched her chest, wincing, and Daniel stepped close, taking a tissue and slowly wiping the blood from the corner of her mouth. Then he embraced her. His hand trailed down her spine, bumping over the strap of her bra beneath the thick sweatshirt and settling into her lower back. He pulled her close. She tensed and groaned slightly. He tilted her head back and, despite the residue of blood, kissed her hard on the lips. She groaned, frowning, and he released her.
Sorry,
he whispered. Don't be. He pressed his face against hers once more, pulling her body into him, and then stepped back as if forcing himself to. She shut off the stovetop gas and they returned to the living room. She looked around the apartment. It was sterile, worn in the way of faded elegance, like rich folks downsizing, retiring. The bland furniture had been top quality 10-15 years ago, but was dinged and scuffed. The cushions had suffered from too many backsides, the carpet from too many leather heels.
Ugly, yes.
But it was quiet and secluded. Safe. The decorations were largely nautical. Prints of ships in turbulent waves, as well as seafaring memorabilia and lanterns and fishing gear. Gabriella regarded the wooden display rack of knots on the wall. Yours?
That's right. I tied them. A hobby.
He looked over the short pieces of rope bound into nautical knots, 2 dozen of them.
They have names, each one.
Another wall was devoted to photography. He spotted the direction of her eyes.
Not as good as yours.
You've got an Edward Weston and an Imogen Cunningham. Stieglitz.
They're just reproductions, not originals.
Well done, though. Quality work. And picking those pieces in particular. Weston was a groundbreaker. Cunningham, too, though I think she needed more of an edge.
And there, something your daughter would appreciate.
On one wall was an antique riding crop and a pair of spurs. An indelible image of Sarah came to mind. Sarah. She sensed Daniel was about to bring up a serious topic. She was right.
Mac, I'm going to have some people help us.
He nodded toward his iPad, on which he'd presumably been sending and receiving emails. Help us?
They're good folks, and we need them.
I can't ask that.
You didn't ask.
Daniel smiled.
Besides, I owe you big time. You're the one who came up with the Princeton solution. I don't know what would have happened if you hadn't been there. It would have been a nightmare.
I'll bet you could have handled it.
No. You saved my life,
he told her. Gabriella offered a modest smile. Who are they, these people?
A couple of guys I've worked with for years. Smart. We need smart.
Daniel regarded her ambling eyes.
She'll be okay, Mac. I promise. Sarah will be okay.
And Gabriella thought, promise. What an odd verb. A word you can't trust, or shouldn't. Like the word trust itself. Don't be so cynical, she thought. But that was hard. Gabriella was cynical in the grain. She'd learned to be that way because of the professor. She saw the man's still face, waxy, surrounded by satin, a material she had come to despise.
They'll be here soon.
He squinted, looking her way.
What are you thinking? Something important, I can tell.
In a soft voice, no.
No, you're not thinking? Or no, you're not telling? It's gotta be door number two, because you can't not be thinking something. That's impossible.
She tried to formulate the words so they didn't come out foolish. This wasn't easy. Too many people turn away when something bad's happening. They're afraid. They're worried about the inconvenience, worried about being embarrassed. But you're not willing to let Joseph get away with this, and you're doing it for me, for somebody you've known for only a couple of days. Daniel Reardon wasn't able to blush, she assessed. But he was embarrassed by her words.
You're giving me a complex.
He looked around and noted the bar.
I need a drink. You? Wine? Anything stronger?
No, just not now. He opened a bottle of Cabernet and poured the ruby liquid into a glass. A long sip seemed to exorcise her cloying gratitude. He had another.
Now, we should think about our next steps. Andrew and Sam should be here soon. First, I guess we ought to call the complication. Make sure he's home.
Complication. She smiled at the word. Then scrolled through her phone until she found Frank Walsh's name and called. No answer. She sent a text. But I'm sure the list is safe. There's no reason it wouldn't be. Daniel's face remained calm. Though, of course, he'd be thinking, without that list, your daughter's dead. And the man who'd kill her, that prick Joseph, will be after you too before long. And he didn't need to add that Joseph would be looking for him too. But then her phone buzzed and she glanced at the screen. A text had appeared. She smiled briefly. It's Frank. He's not going out tonight. Everything's fine.
That's one less worry we have. But I don't know how I feel about Mr. Frank Complication Walsh on your speed dial list. I'm thinking I'd rather take his place.
I could move you up to number two.
Only two?
Mom is first.
That's fair enough.
Daniel walked to a tall, glass-fronted mahogany entertainment enclosure, circa 1975, she guessed, though it contained newer components. He turned the radio onto a local station. After 5 minutes of bad music and worse commercials, it was time for the news. She strode to the device and abruptly shut it off. Daniel looked at her as she stared at the receiver. She told him, I don't want to hear about it. About what happened today. Any of it. It has to be on the news. I'm all over the news. Her voice had grown ragged again.
It's okay. It's okay.
She started at the buzz from the intercom. It seemed loud as an alarm.
Daniel?
Came the voice through the speaker.
It's Andrew.
Daniel nodded reassuringly and whispered to Gabriella.
The cavalry's arrived.
Chapter 31. 2:15 p.m. Sunday. 1 hour earlier. Detective Brad Kepler watched his boss read the media release once, twice,
again.
Captain Paul Barkley looked up at the NYPD press officer, a wobbly young man with persistent acne, who sat before him in this hellhole of an operations room. Then, without saying a word, he looked down and read once more.
Barclay's stomach made a Harley-Davidson noise that everyone in the room pretended to ignore. Kepler knew that most Sundays, this time of day, Barclay was tucking away his wife's roast beef, along with, when she wasn't looking, massive forkfuls of buttered mashed potatoes. The detective was aware of this routine because he'd been invited to dinner a few times. He had three repetitive memories of the occasions. Barclay telling the same quasi-blue jokes over and over, the roast beef being very good, and Kepler's spending the entire time trying to figure out if there were any possible scenarios for telling Barclay's know-it-all college student daughter to shut the hell up. Which, of course, there were not. Kepler himself read the release again. Fred Stanford Chapman, 29. Wife, Elizabetta, 31. Two children, Kyle and Sophie. Surgery to remove a bullet lodged near his heart is planned for later today. Investigations continue. Prognosis is not good. Etc., etc., etc.
How many calls?
Barclay asked the youngster.
From the press? 100.
Barclay snapped.
That's an exaggeration.
Kepler thought. Probably isn't. His partner, Naresh Sarani, seemed to concur.
I wanted to keep it quiet,
the captain said.
A shooting?
From the PA youngster.
Yes, a shooting. In goddamn Manhattan. I wanted to keep it goddamn quiet. But I guess that didn't work out, did it? This was a leak the size of the Titanic.
Kepler corrected.
The Titanic wasn't a leak. The Titanic was a ship that got sunk because of a leak.
But, of course, the edit was tacit. Barclay snatched up a pen and began to revise, which gave Kepler the chance to look around their new digs. This was the second room the Charles Prescott operation, the CP op, had been assigned to in the past 2 days. Sure, this happened to be a busy time for bad guys, and little operations like the CP op didn't mean very much in terms of chalking up cred, so they had to take whatever room was free at the moment. But this one was the pits. The 20-by-30-foot space did have a few high-def monitors, but they were off, and they didn't even seem hooked up. The walls were scuffed, nothing new there, and the government-issue furniture was cheap. Nearly a third of the floor space was devoted to storage. Something smelled off, too, as if a takeout turkey sandwich had fallen behind one of the filing cabinets a long, long time ago. At least it couldn't get any worse. Barclay slid the press release back like an air hockey puck.
Fix it. And by the way, no comment from me other than the investigations continue. Stop at that. Nothing more.
The press officer tried again.
But 100 calls, sir.
Why are you still here?
Barclay made a sound like a disagreeable transmission. This one came from his throat, not his belly.
Yes, sir. Sorry, sir.
The public affairs officer scooted out.
Why the hell does that kid wear a sidearm?
Kepler thought. Barclay turned to the two detectives sitting at a battered fiberboard table and barked,
Jesus.
He nodded toward Kepler's copy of the release. Fred Stanford Chapman, 29. Gunshot wound. Then the boss changed direction.
Now, her.
He didn't need to say Gabriella. There were no other women causing them so much anxiety at the moment.
I told you yesterday I wanted her under surveillance. 24/7. What the hell happened? You were at her place, right? Cameras, microphones. Her.
Brad Kepler shrugged.
She tipped to us, I don't know, and then started using evasive tactics. The hell does that mean? Sounds like something from a bad cop movie.
But,
Kepler said,
we're still on her.
A glance at his partner.
Right?
Sarani called surveillance, had a discussion, then clapped his hand over the mouthpiece and said to Barclay and Kepler,
we've got officers close. It's righteous.
Which sounded like something out of an even worse cop movie.
Righteous?
The captain asked,
how'd you manage the tail if she slipped you at her place?
Sarani explained.
Brad got a GPS on her.
How the hell you do that?
The captain gave one of his broad frowns that he used for emphasis, a gesture several of his detectives had developed pretty good imitations of, Brad Kepler included.
She was distracted. It was chaos, weapons, screaming, diving for cover. I got the thing into her jacket pocket.
Barkley was pleased, Kepler could tell, but his nature required him to ask,
You think that was a safe idea?
The captain could never just say, good job.
Safe idea? Kepler asked.
He didn't know what that meant.
I frankly didn't think about it. It was just something I had to do. Get the tracker onto her, then back off.
Sarani, his gray complexion even grayer under the inhumane lights in the dismal operations room, said,
It was pretty good. Pretty smooth. She doesn't have a clue.
Microphone?
The captain brushed his trim white hair, senior congressman's hair, twice, then a third time. He seemed to look Kepler up and down as if approving of his impressive tan. Or disapproving.
No, just a tracker. We lost her for a bit in the subway.
The New York City metro system was huge and fast and efficient, and that meant it could transport Gabriella anywhere within a several hundred square mile area, and GPS trackers wouldn't work there. But then she surfaced. CCTV got a facial recognition exiting a station in Midtown. The signal's been solid since then.
Unless she decides to hop on the A train again.
She can't live in the MTA, Sarani said. The food sucks down there. And the showers? Forget about it.
This drew a hard glance from Kepler, because the joke was beyond stupid. It wasn't even a joke.
And she was with the guy?
That's right.
Stay on her. But I want everybody tailing to be invisible. You follow me? If surveillance gets made, then people could get killed. That's not happening on my watch.
And why not? Kepler wondered of the dramatic pronouncement. You can protect all the innocents in New York City, can you now, boss?
A lot of people have died on your watch over the years when you think about it.
But Sarani said only, We've told the teams to stay back. They're near, but not too close. One of the deputy chiefs stuck his head in the doorway.
Hey, sorry, gentlemen, need to commandeer this room.
What?
Barkley snapped.
Move again? You gotta be kidding me.
The white-haired, rotund brass shrugged, looking only slightly contrite.
Got a terrorist tip and we need an ISDN line. They're not up and running in the other rooms.
Terrorist. We get 1,000 terrorist tips a year. Why is this one a big deal?
Bureau's running it. Pretty serious. And could be going down in 2-3 weeks. Infrastructure target, that sort of thing. You got 10 minutes to find new digs.
He disappeared. Kepler glanced at Sarani and knew that his partner was just barely refraining from giving the empty doorway the finger. They swapped smiles. Sighing, Barkley looked over sheets of paper on the table. One was headed, Charles Prescott Investments. The other was another copy of the press release. Surgery to remove a bullet lodged near his heart is planned for later today.
We'll make this work. I know we will.
This flimsy reassurance came from Kepler. Just then, Sarani got another call. He listened. He disconnected. Surveillance. Gabriella and Reardon are on the move again. Near 48 and 7th, moving west. There are a couple unmarked in the vicinity, but they're staying out of sight.
Vicinity. Jesus,
Kepler thought. Barkley slid the Prescott file away as if it reminded him of a bad medical diagnosis. He asked,
Is the tracker a good one?
Kepler said,
Yeah, battery lasts for days and it'll pinpoint the location down to 6 feet.
Sarani added proudly,
And she'll never spot it. It's inside a big pen.
Chapter 30. 2:10 p.m. Sunday. 5 minutes earlier. The sky had changed for the worse. The spongy clouds, which had been floating so benign and frivolous in the azure sky, were gone. Taupe overcast stretched from horizon to horizon, as if the air itself were tethered to the raw edge of these past 30 hours. The harbor was choppy, the wind rude. Gabriella and Daniel were emerging from the subway.
After the screams, after the chaos on 2nd Avenue not long ago,
The police had appeared in droves. She and Daniel had had no choice but to use the subway system to flee, despite the risk of getting spotted by Transit Authority police. But no one had noticed them, and on the streets now, they maneuvered among families, tourists, shoppers, and lovers, trying to find cover in the crowds, just as the two fugitives had lost themselves in the various subway lines for the past half hour. They'd ridden to Harlem from the Upper East Side, then headed crosstown, and finally south to Midtown. From here, they'd walked to the apartment that Daniel had told her about, the one his company, the Norwalk Fund, kept for out-of-town clients. It was presently empty, and they could hide out there. He now looked around carefully.
No police, no Joseph, no anybody else after us.
Gabriella was solemn.
All the blood, Daniel. Did you see it?
Of course he had. He squeezed her hand tighter. The pressure seemed to have meaning.
But what?
She couldn't tell. Look. He too noted the blue and white patrol car speeding their way, the lights flashing urgently. Gabriella shucked the backpack off her shoulder and they veered, stepping closer to a store, putting a stream of passersby between them and the street. The NYPD cruiser, though, sped quickly past, heading in the direction of the incident.
The blood.
Daniel directed her east.
The apartment's that way, about 8-10 blocks, not far.
But before they started walking, Gabriella took his arm and said,
Wait, let's ditch the hats and get some better camouflage.
She tapped the dark, logo-free baseball cap she was wearing.
We need more than this to fool them.
Nodding at a discount clothing store up the block,
Let's go shopping.
5 minutes later, they were out, wearing jeans, his blue, hers black, and sweatshirts and windbreakers, also dark. His top said NYU. Hers was bare of type or images. The clothes they'd been wearing were in shopping bags. She grimaced and clutched her ribcage, coughed, then wiped a spot of blood from her lip.
Mac,
she said dismissingly.
It's all right, I can handle it.
They continued walking. Her phone pinged, a text. She glanced at the screen. A smile, dampened by a wince, appeared.
The complication.
What did he say?
He got his present.
Gabriella decided not to tell him the rest that Frank Walsh had texted. They were at the corner when a dark sedan sped by, clearly an unmarked police car. This one, unlike the squad cars a moment ago, slowed as it grew close, then sped up and continued on, vanishing around the corner. No other police cars or uniformed officers were in the area.
I think it's clear,
Daniel said. Into his backpack, he stuffed the shopping bag containing the gray Canali suit and shirt he'd changed out of at the store. Gabriella examined the contents of her bag and noticed spatters of blood on her sweater and windbreaker.
I'm dumping these. Shit. I loved that sweater.
She went through the pockets and kept only the money. Everything else, receipts, bloody tissues, and a big pen, she left in the bag. She looked around and noticed a Department of Sanitation truck, filled to the brim, en route to the processing facility on 14th Street at the Hudson River. She slung the shopping bag into the back of the truck as the driver waited for the light to change. Gabriella gripping his arm, Daniel set a good pace, and they wove through the herds of pedestrians filling the streets on this blustery Sunday afternoon. Chapter 29. 1:40 p.m. Sunday, 30 minutes earlier. Frank Walsh was standing in the tiny kitchen of his dim Greenwich Village apartment, thinking of the killing that morning. It hadn't been easy. Using a knife never was. The problem was, you generally couldn't stab somebody to death. You had to slash, go for the neck, the legs, the femoral arteries. The groin was good, too. But stabbing? It took forever. And add to the mix, if the person you were fighting was good at defense, as the victim that morning had been, you had to stay alert, you had to move, you had to be fast, and you had to improvise. In knife fighting, advantages changed in seconds. Solid, okay, pudgy Frank
pulled his Greek fisherman cap off and scratched his unruly red hair and the scalp beneath as he stood at the open cupboard door. With his left hand, he absently pinched a roll of fat around his belly. He decided against the potato chips. He continued to debate the food options, but was distracted. Gabby was on his mind, as often she was. Then his mind, his clever mind, slipped back to the fight that morning. Recalling the animal lust, the pure satisfaction, born somewhere, a shrink would probably say, out of revenge for the bullying he'd suffered as a teenager. He felt pride, too, at his skill with the blade. He wished he could tell Gabby about the confrontation, though, some things he knew it was best to keep from her. Felt a deep pang in his belly as he pictured her and thought of the present he'd just received. He wondered what she was wearing at the moment. Then he turned his attention back to mealtime. His kitchen was a central hub of the apartment. The cabinets were white, and the handles had actual release levers as if the room were a galley on a ship that regularly sailed through gales. If the doors weren't secured, Doritos, tuna helper, and macaroni and cheese would fly to the floor in the swells. Chips? No chips? No chips, he decided, and continued to stare. He took a breath and sensed something smelled off. Not spoiled food. What? He looked around. Noted the old scabby table, plumbed steady with folded post-it notes under one leg. His hat sat on it. Was the hat gamey? He smelled it. Yep, that was it. Did Greek fishermen really wear Greek fisherman hats? He wondered. He'd have to wash it, he guessed. But would that take the good luck away? He'd worn it during the fight that morning. He slipped it into a baggie until he decided. Back to the Titanic cabinets and the fridge. No chips, but not doing the celery thing. Celery is evil. An apple. Frank snagged a shiny red Macintosh, huge, and a bag of Ruffles, and loped back to his cluttered desk, snug in the corner of his bedroom. Just as he sat in the plush chair, he thought, hell, forgot the beverage. The beverage. He returned to the kitchen and got a Diet Coke from the chair beside the table, filled with magazines and books, piled high. He glanced at the present Gabby had sent him. His heart stuttered. Man, he was in heaven. Gabby. How much have we lost? He wondered, squeezing his belly. 6 pounds in the past month, if he weighed himself after peeing. He munched and sipped, wishing the soda was cold. Should have fridged it. Why do I forget things? Frank Walsh knew he had trouble focusing, but he also took pride that it was a negative compensation for being so talented in other ways. Like his knives. He regarded his specimens of cutting-edge weapons, which took up 2 bookshelves. When was the curved kukri going to arrive? He thought of the beautiful blade. The picture on eBay had depicted a classic Nepalese army knife. Then he returned to reality. All the post-it notes I keep buying. Have to remember to use them for more than propping up table legs. Right. Put the soda in the fridge. How hard was that? He slowed down on the chips. Take your time. Write that down, too. Don't eat another until you've masticated and swallowed the one you're working on. He noted that the soda, because it was frigging warm, had sprayed onto the Samsung monitor when he'd opened the can. He wiped the glass with an old t-shirt, aromatic with Windex he kept beside the computer. He'd have to wash the cloth soon. That was gamey, too. Like the maybe Greek fisherman hat. Write it down. He would. Frank didn't write it down and returned to the computer, unable to stop thinking of the knife fight again. Ah, it was beautiful. Choreography. Dance. Beautiful. His knife sweeping down, then stopping halfway as his victim went into a defensive posture, which Frank had anticipated. and he'd then spun around backward and whisked his steel blade along the exposed neck. Blood flew and sprayed and danced into the sky. Then, fast, he never hesitated. He leapt to the right and slashed again on the other side of the neck. And the dying eyes stared, motionless for a moment, then closed slowly as the pool of blood spread. Wait, Frank Walsh thought. Was that his phone? He grabbed for it. No. He'd hoped Gabby would call. Well, he knew she'd call. But he meant now. This moment. He stared at the phone, willing it to ring. It didn't. He thought more about the coming Tuesday. A brief fantasy played itself out. The doorman, Arthur, ringing on the intercom and saying,
"There's somebody here to see you. Her name's Gabriella."
Frank Walsh would smile.
"Send her up."
And he'd be waiting for her in his black jeans and black shirt. His best look. His thin look. Teeth brushed and hair sprayed and body deodorized. His fisherman cap would be in a baggie if he hadn't washed it first, which probably wasn't going to happen. He'd pull out the present she'd just had delivered today. She'd turn her beautiful, piercing eyes on him, and they'd crinkle with fun and flirt. She'd say, "I've never seen your bedroom, Frank." He looked at the note that accompanied the gift. "Dear Frank, thinking of you."
Oh, man.
Then Frank revised the fantasy. In the remake, a slightly more risque version, they sat on the couch, knees touching, and watched an old movie on cable instead of going to the film festival. The present, he found himself actually stroking the box now, would play a role in this fantasy too. A central role. They'd pick something noir to watch, of course. Maybe The Asphalt Jungle or Pulp Fiction. It would be like Travolta and Uma Thurman dancing. He loved that movie. Though he always wondered, if Travolta was such a brilliant hitman, why the hell did he leave his machine gun outside the bathroom for Bruce Willis to find it when he went to take a dump? They could watch that, or Reservoir Dogs, or Inglourious Basterds. Or hell, they'd watch anything that Gabby wanted to watch. They'd talk, they'd have sex. He pictured her crying with pleasure, maybe with a little pain. And then they'd talk some more. She'd learn all about him. She'd learn who was the real Franklin Walsh. He flopped down on the saggy bed and sent her a text. He thanked her for the present and then, he couldn't resist, described what he had in mind for their date next Tuesday. He included a few suggestions about apparel. All very tasteful, he decided. Then he replayed in his mind the knife fight. Once, twice, again and again. The blood, the screams, the body twitching. Mostly the blood. Chapter 28. 1 p.m. Sunday, 40 minutes earlier. In his rhythmic, purposeful gait, Joseph Astor walked through the maze-like streets of this curious neighborhood like a tourist, eyes constantly moving. He'd swapped the long black trench coat for black cargo pants, t-shirt, and leather jacket. He was making his way back to the apartment he'd been to earlier this morning, though via a different route. This part of town was confusing. Avenues going every which way. His GPS app was helpful, but he wasn't moving in the most direct route, of course. He was taking his time, doubling back, striking through alleys and vacant lots. This confused the smartphone app girl, Siri, but there wasn't an option for picking routes to avoid spots where some a-hole is waiting to put a bullet in my head. The air was chill and clouds ganged on the horizon, sending bands of long, dim shadow over the sidewalks and streets and buildings here. The earlier sunlight was history. This was too bad because, believe it or not, bright light made witnesses' accounts less reliable than overcast. Glare could be wonderfully obscuring. Victims, too, might not even see you or the gun when you approached. He looked around once more. The residences were small, many of them red brick or dirt brown stone that had once been white or light gray. A lot of soot and grime. He passed a bookstore for the gay, lesbian, transgendered crowd, a laundromat, apartments with elaborate wrought iron security bars. You could look right into the minuscule, street-level living rooms, which would fit no more than 4 or 5 people. Who'd live like that? Plenty, Joseph reflected, to judge from the number of the cells he passed.
Manhattan.
In his mind, Joseph once more ran through the complex scheme he was orchestrating this weekend. Many parts, many challenges, many risks. But being in a reflective mood, he was thinking that men are born to work. It didn't matter how difficult your job, how filthy your hands got, in all senses of that phrase. It didn't matter if you were a poet or a carpenter or a scientist or whatever. God made us to get off our backsides and go out into the world and do something with our time. And Joseph was never happier than when he was working. Even if, as he was about to do in a few minutes, that job was murder. The silent GPS sent him around the corner and he paused. There was the brown brick building where his victim lived. Thinking of how the night would unfold, Joseph again pictured Gabriella, her beautiful heart-shaped face, her attractive figure, all of which jarred with the edgy voice. He thought, too, of the man with her, Daniel Reardon. He'd seemed smart, and his eyes radiated confidence, which diminished only slightly when Joseph had displayed the butt of his pistol. He thought, too, of the October list. A complicated night lay ahead, but nothing he couldn't handle. Now, no police in sight, he strode nonchalantly past the apartment building's door, glancing in. Yes, the doorman he'd seen earlier was still on duty. Joseph was a bit irritated at the old man's presence at the desk, which added a complication, but no matter. Anything could be worked around with enough determination and ingenuity. And Joseph was well fitted with both. He circled around to the back and counted windows, recalling the diagrams from the NYC Buildings Department of the structure's layout. Yes, his target was home. He could see movement in the flicker of light, as if from a TV or computer monitor. Shadows. A light spread out and a moment later shrank and went out, probably from a refrigerator door, since the glow came from the kitchen. This reminded him he wanted a long sip or two from his special brew. But later, he was busy now. Work to be done. Joseph went to the service door. It was locked, naturally. Verifying that he couldn't be seen from any of the windows, he removed a screwdriver from his inside pocket and began to jimmy. This was all you needed 90% of the time. Lockpicking tools were usually more trouble than they were worth. He double-checked his pistol, then concentrated again on his task of cracking the lock. Irritated that his target, Gabriella's friend Frank Walsh, lived on the 6th floor. His breath hissed out softly as he reflected that the last thing he needed right now was a climb up that many stairs. Chapter 27. 11:50 a.m. Sunday. 1 hour, 10 minutes earlier.
I don't see him.
Daniel Reardon was referring to the man who'd been following him and Gabriella from the chaos on Madison Avenue. The man in the rumpled gray suit and a bright yellow shirt. The man with the eyes of a hunting dog. Gabriella said, "Who the hell is he? I don't think he's a cop."
"No, he would have called for backup. There'd be 1,000 cars here if he was."
They were moving quickly south on 2nd Avenue. The wind was now brisk. Clouds were coagulating low in the sky. The cross streets were still in the high digits. Fewer stores, more residences, so the sidewalks were less crowded than closer to Midtown. They looked behind once again.
"Maybe it was just a coincidence we saw him a couple of times."
"You really think that?"
Daniel asked.
"No," she gasped. "But frankly, I don't know what to think anymore."
She winced as she held her side and stopped.
Still hurts?
Does, yeah, she said.
She touched away a dot of blood on her cheek.
Doctor?
No. The police might have contacted the emergency rooms. Let's just keep going.
If you broke a rib and pierced a lung,
he said, troubled,
that could be a real problem.
I'll have to live with it, she shot back.
Then, softer,
until we have Sarah, I'll live with it.
They started again, making as much speed as they could away from the site of the incident just moments before. Daniel asked,
what could he want? That man?
In the yellow shirt?
Yeah.
Gabriella shrugged as if it was obvious.
If it isn't a coincidence, he wants the October list. What else? Joseph can't be the only one after it, I'm sure.
Daniel was silent, head tilted. After another scan of the sidewalks behind them, he said,
there's another possibility about Yellow Shirt.
What's that, Daniel?
He's working for Charles Prescott.
She frowned.
Working for my boss? What do you mean?
Daniel continued,
your boss sent this guy to track you down, to find out what you could have against him, information, evidence, to talk you out of testifying and going to the police.
Gabriella shook her head.
Charles would just call me up and talk to me.
Daniel replied,
the Charles Prescott you worked for, the Prescott you thought you knew, might do that. But that's not the real Prescott. After what you've learned about him, don't you think he's capable of calling somebody up to do his dirty work for him?
Dirty work?
She clutched his arm.
You don't think he'd hurt me?
Emphasis on the verb, as if it was too difficult to say kill. Daniel's voice was soft as he said,
it's a possibility, Mac. We've got to consider it. You're the perfect witness. You can place Prescott at locations he doesn't want to be associated with. You know his girlfriend. You can testify about all kinds of things. And now, you found the October list.
And when she said, no, this time her tone suggested even she didn't believe Charles Prescott was incapable of hurting her. Gabriella looked behind them, down the wide sidewalk.
Yellow Shirt, where is he? I don't know where he is.
Her voice crackled with panic.
It's all right, we lost him in the crowds.
No, there he is!
Daniel's head swiveled too.
Right.
Yellow Shirt was a block away, dodging pedestrians, moving steadily forward.
What are we going to do? If he stops us, Sarah's gone. I can't let that happen.
Her wide eyes, rimmed red, stared toward Daniel.
Just keep going, faster.
But only two blocks later, she pulled up abruptly and arched her back, wincing and moaning. Her knees sagged, and only Daniel's strong arm kept her from rolling onto the sidewalk.
It hurts, Daniel. My chest hurts. I have to rest. Just for a minute.
She looked around.
There. He won't see us there.
Daniel helped her out of the crowds into the shadowy space she'd indicated between two parked trucks. Noisy traffic zipped past. Daniel looked out, back in the direction where they'd last spotted the man.
I don't see him.
Gabriella leaned against the hood of the Mercedes truck, a sprinter, and cradled her chest. Another glance behind them.
Nothing,
he assured her.
No cops, either. We'll give it a minute, then keep going. We'll get to the apartment. You can rest. Find out how badly you're hurt.
He's probably turned down a side street, don't you think? We tricked him,
Daniel said.
Could be.
Okay, Gabriella whispered. Then let's go. I need to rest. I need to think.
There's a Lexington line station a block away. Can you make it?
Sure. I'm better now.
They turned to the sidewalk.
Wait!
A man's voice called.
I want to talk to you!
They swiveled around. Yellow Shirt had appeared from the traffic side of the gap between the trucks. The skin on his fat face was sweaty. He walked up fast, starting to speak and lifting his hands in an ambiguous way. Could be a greeting, could be a threat. Then he was reaching into his breast pocket. Gabriella reacted fast. She stepped away from Daniel, placed both hands on the man's chest, and shoved. As he stumbled back into traffic, she said to Daniel, "Let's go! Run!" But before they could start down the sidewalk, There came a squeal of brakes, and a large delivery truck struck Yellowshirt at close to 45 miles per hour. He tumbled beneath the wheels, and a sickening, crumpled box sound filled the air around them. No time for the driver to hit the horn. No time even for the man to scream. Gabriella cried out, staring at the shattered figure.
Oh, Jesus, no! No, no!
A thick wash of dark blood spread out behind the truck, which had slammed into a cab trying to avoid the man.
No!
Shouts, screams, people running toward the man's crushed body. People running away. Cell phones appearing for 911 calls. And for pictures. Daniel Reardon took her arm.
Mac, we have to leave now!
I didn't mean to do it. I just reacted.
She stared, shaking.
Listen to me.
Daniel gripped her face and turned it toward him, ignoring her wince of pain.
We have to go.
But
he was a threat. He had to be a threat. He wouldn't have followed us if he wasn't. You didn't have any choice. It looked like he was going to attack you. He was reaching into his pocket. Maybe he had a gun.
You don't know that. Look, he's still moving. His foot, it's moving.
She stared at the blood, choked a cry. Daniel's strong arm encircled her shoulders like a vice, and he was walking her away. She half stumbled, half jogged beside him. It was as if she could barely remember how to walk. His voice was tinted with panic, too.
I know you're upset. I know you're hurting, but we have to move, Mac.
She began, shaking.
I don't think...
But Daniel interrupted.
It's all about your daughter. Remember what you keep saying. Focus. Well, focus on your daughter.
My...
She gasped.
Sarah.
He said the name firmly.
I'm sorry, Mac. It's a damn shame this happened. But it did, and we're not going to be able to help Sarah if you go to jail. There'll be a time to deal with it. Later.
Her face a pale mask. Gabriella nodded.
Keep moving.
She followed as if she were a toddler unsure how to walk. Suddenly he froze.
No, wait, go the other way. We'll circle around the block to the subway.
Why? What's wrong?
The way we were going, there's a meter maid at the corner.
Meter maid? She asked. What difference does that make?
Daniel leaned close and whispered.
Gabriella, everybody in New York City, from dog catchers to the FBI, is looking for you now.
Chapter 26. 11:35 a.m. Sunday. 15 minutes earlier.
In the trenches. Think. Figure this out,
Hal Dixon told himself.
You work in the trenches. Improvise.
He looked around the streets, spotted someone he thought could help. Dixon strode up to the hot dog vendor who guided away the smoke of the coals warming chestnuts and pretzels in his cart with the wave of a hand. The smoke returned instantly. The smell made Dixon hungry, but he was on his mission, and he ignored the sensation.
Please, I need to ask you something,
he said to the skinny vendor in jeans and a Mets t-shirt.
A couple came by here, a man and a woman, just a few minutes ago.
The man glanced at Dixon's wrinkled gray suit and bright yellow shirt, and maybe came to some conclusion about the color combination. Then he was looking back at Dixon's sweaty face.
Man and woman?
A faint accent. Dixon described them. The hot dog man was instantly uneasy.
I didn't see anything. Nothing, no.
It's okay. I'm a deacon.
Trying to calm him.
In a church. Presbyterian,
the rumpled man said breathlessly.
In New Jersey, a deacon.
Said the street vendor, who seemed to be a Muslim and would probably have no idea what a deacon was, but might appreciate devotion.
Religious. I'm a religious person.
A priest?
The man asked, becoming confused. He was again regarding Dixon's old suit and yellow shirt.
No, I'm just religious. A deacon's a layperson.
Oh. The vendor looked around for somebody he could sell a hot dog to.
Mistake.
Dixon said,
I'm like a priest.
Oh.
A private person who helps the priest, like helping the imam.
Imam?
Look.
Dixon reached into his breast pocket and took a small, black-bound Bible from it.
Oh.
The man said this with some reverence.
I was just on Madison Avenue.
He gestured broadly, though the vendor would obviously know where Madison Avenue was.
Yes. And what happened was I saw this woman commit a crime, a bad crime. The woman I just described.
A crime?
That's right.
The vendor touched his chest with his fingertips, perhaps a form of prayer. Dixon noted his hands were filthy. He decided he'd never get a hot dog from a street vendor again. The man asked,
All the sirens? Is that what's going on?
Yes, all the sirens. Lots of sirens.
Dixon pulled a napkin out of the holder, then two more. He wiped his face.
You want some water, Father?
I call you, Father. Is that what you say?
No, I'm not a reverend, Dixon said. I don't want any water. A deacon, it's like a priest.
Okay, but if you do, just ask. A bottle or a soda.
Here's what I need. You don't have cell phone and you want to borrow mine?
No, no.
I need to find out where they went. She and this other man, a friend of hers, I guess. I'm going to talk to them, help them give themselves up.
The vendor blinked, waved at the smoke again.
Dixon repeated, She should surrender to the police. I'll help her, but she has to do it now. If they run, the police will think they're guilty and they may just shoot them down. They're panicked. I know they are.
What do they call that people in your Bible who help other people?
What? Oh, Samaritan,
Dixon said, wiping more sweat. The pits of his shirt were grayish-yellow.
Yeah, that's it.
My Bible. I guess I am. I don't know. They came this way.
The vendor was more comfortable now.
Yes, these people you're talking about, I saw them. A few minutes ago. I saw them because they were walking fast, and they were rude, too.
Dixon's heart beat a bit faster.
Where did they go?
They went into that store there. Do you see it?
On the corner.
Next to the corner, the souvenir store.
It was only 40 or so feet away.
Did you see them leave?
No, I think they're still in there, but I wasn't paying too much attention. They might have left.
Thank you. I think you've saved some lives.
Dixon started across the street, then paused. The couple slipped from the store. They were wearing hats, and she had a different bag, Dixon believed, but it was clearly them. They gazed up and down the street, spotted Dixon, and froze for a moment. Then they vanished in the opposite direction. He noted the woman seemed to be limping. Dixon started after them.
Be careful,
the vendor said, his voice deflating as if he wanted to append the word father, but was recalling that Dixon wasn't one.
If they've done a crime, they might not understand you want to help them. They might be desperate, dangerous.
I've made my peace with God,
Dixon called breathlessly as he broke into a trot, tapping his chest to make sure the small Bible was seated firmly in his pocket. Chapter 25. 11:10 a.m. Sunday, 25 minutes earlier.
The gun just went off,
Gabriella whispered, her voice the tone of hysteria.
I didn't mean to do it.
Daniel remained silent. He steered her quickly down the sidewalk away from the scene of the shooting. She asked desperately,
He didn't die, did he? What did you see, Daniel? What did you see?
Still no response. Sirens filled the air around them as they headed east from Madison Avenue. There were lights, too, piercing white and blue flashers, and reflections of white and blue flashers in windows. Lights seemed to be everywhere. Daniel and Gabriella kept their heads down. They didn't dare look up. Then he directed her quickly to the side, a 90-degree turn. She nearly stumbled, but he held her firmly.
What?
She gasped. A car skidded to a stop, an unmarked police car. Two detectives in suits leapt out and headed into a crowded specialty food store, displaying their badges.
Do they think we're in there? She asked.
Just keep walking.
Manic, Gabriella asked,
He didn't die, did he? He was so young. Please tell me.
Her grip must have hurt. He frowned. She relented.
I don't know, Mac. I'm sorry, but I don't know. It's possible.
Walking as fast as they dared without drawing attention, they moved east, leaving the unmarked car behind. She glanced back. The officers didn't appear. She and Daniel hurried south, then east again. To anyone else's eye, they resembled a typical couple. Not particularly jovial, not particularly conversational. Harried. A relationship limbed by stress, money woes, child woes, sexual woes. Life in Manhattan, professionals. Yet every glance their way seemed tinted with suspicion. But no one pointed. No one called out. No one seemed about to rip cell phones from holsters and speed dial 911. No one fled from the homicidal auburn-haired woman and her actor look-alike companion.
I didn't think, Daniel. There was the gun. It was just there. I grabbed it. It went off. I've never even touched one before. I was just... Oh, Jesus. What have I done?
A look behind revealed a half dozen pedestrians, but no police. Still, Gabriella focused on a man in a suit, a rumpled gray one of thin cloth that seemed inadequate in the chill. He was walking in their direction. She noticed him because of his yellow shirt. His stride seemed purposeful, though he wasn't paying particular attention to them. Gabriella nudged Daniel.
That guy? Yellow shirt. Look carefully.
Got it.
I've seen him before, I think. On Madison.
He followed us from the shooting?
I don't know.
Gabriella winced, gasped, then stopped abruptly, her hand on her side.
It's bad?
He asked, gesturing down toward her ribs. A nod.
Can you walk?
Yes.
Though she frowned when they began again. They kept their heads down, not looking anywhere but at the sidewalk. Suddenly, Daniel took her arm and guided her quickly into a Korean deli, where they paused to examine the fresh-cut flowers and a tub of ice in which nestled plastic bottles of orange and mango juice.
What?
Gabriella asked in a whisper.
Cops.
A police cruiser sped past silently, but its lights pierced as harshly as a siren. Blue and white. A moment later, they took to the sidewalk again. They dodged through traffic and bicyclists and joggers and more pedestrians. When they hit the uptown downtown street, another police car sped past. She looked back and said urgently,
I thought I saw him again, the yellow shirt guy.
When they reached the next intersection, another police car sped past. It didn't slow, but the officers were looking around. He said,
We need to get out of sight. There's a place we can stay.
Where?
The Norwalk Fund has an apartment for out-of-town clients.
Norwalk? Oh, your company, right?
He nodded.
It's empty now. Off First Avenue in the 50s.
He noted the cross street sign. 79th.
It's a long walk, he said, but I'm worried about cabs. They have that new video system, the TVs. Your picture might show up on the screen.
I can walk, sure.
After 5 minutes, he paused and examined her.
You can't walk.
She took a breath, then coughed.
Subway. Okay.
She leaned against him again.
Is that man behind us, yellow shirt?
I don't see him.